Intro to Paralegal. This file is going to be a little longer than what you're used to in this class, primarily because it covers ethics and professional responsibility, and we're going to take 2 weeks to go through what is Chapter 4 in your textbook. Ethics and professional responsibility is very important. You should have a firm grasp of our state's ethical rules and specifically the things that apply to paralegals. If a paralegal violates a rule governing attorneys, it may require a result in serious consequence for a client, for that attorney, and for that paralegal. Paralegals are subject to less regulation depending on what state you're in, although states may impose more rules if believed desirable. But paralegals are always regulated indirectly by an attorney in ethical codes and by state law. Now, I've already talked about unauthorized practice of law. So, to emphasize again, you can't provide legal services or legal advice directly to someone, even though probably when you finish this program, you're going to know a lot about the law, and that the more years you spend in practice as a paralegal, you're going to know sometimes more than lawyers that come to work at your firm. If you want to give that legal advice or legal services directly to the public, go become a lawyer. You know, go to law school, take the bar exam, pay your bar dues, and be a lawyer. Now, we as attorneys engage in self-regulation because we have to play a critical role in establishing, you know, what is our profession. And there are various regulators. Traditionally, the American Bar Association that approves our program was one of the primary regulators or helped develop professionalism in the United States for the bar, for lawyers. If you haven't noticed, in a courtroom, there is this divider between the gallery and then where the lawyers and the parties and the jury, the participants in the trial sit. Sometimes in older courtrooms, it looks kind of like a fence. You know, it has slats, maybe ornate or more ornate in some of the older courtrooms. That's the bar. In order to step across or into that area, you either have to be invited as a party, a witness, you know, somebody that the judge allows, because the judge is kind of the gatekeeper there, or you have to be a member of the bar. You have to have passed the licensing expectation for that state or federal court. And there are different expectations for federal courts. I am licensed to practice in the state of Illinois and no other states, but I'm also licensed to practice before the United States District Court for the Central District of Illinois, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which covers three states, and the United States Supreme Court. I have licenses from each of those four different courts and jurisdictions. You have to seek, pass the requirements for those licenses, and then maintain or be in good standing to appear before those courts. Not all lawyers are able or licensed to appear before all of those courts. Basic requirements to have a state license, a bachelor's degree, so a four-year college degree, followed by a law degree, which is, if you're going full-time, 3 years. If you're going part-time, right now it's 5 years. They used to make you finish in 4 years. I started law school when I was working as a police officer, working, you know, more than probably 50 hours a week with overtime, and I had to somehow cram in law school, which it essentially was the equivalent of you're taking four classes instead of five, plus going summers. So it was pretty difficult. You're going 3 years or 4 years full time. Now you can extend that out to 5 years. Once you graduate from law school, actually along the way, if you're in Illinois, in your end of your second year, you take the ethics portion of the bar. There's an exam that covers the things we're talking about here, and you have to pass that part of the exam, and then you apply to sit for the full bar exam. And while you're waiting to graduate law school and be able to sit for the full bar exam, there's a background investigation going on. They're making sure that you have the character to be a lawyer. You pass the bar exam and there's no background issues, you're allowed to go and be sworn in to practice in that state. If you don't have your license, again, it's unauthorized practice of law. And if you're following along with the slides, which you probably should have been doing now, with any podcast, but use the slides that are provided on Blackboard, and they're the slides that coincide with the textbook chapter, which there's also the assumption that you've read that before you even begin any of this. I'm following along with the slides as I'm giving my comments. Now, there are various model codes, but I'm going to focus at the end of this discussion on key elements of the Illinois Code of Professional Responsibility. Those codes are intended to regulate attorneys. They provide sanctions for violations. Formal sanctions can be reprimand, suspension, disbarment. I just had a conversation about someone who ended up in the media doing something totally different now, but they were disbarred. Not many lawyers get disbarred. You have to really mess up to be disbarred. I mean, the rules tell you where you should be and how you should practice, and as long as you stay within those rules, it shouldn't be an issue. But some lawyers do. Beyond that regulation, there's civil liability. You may have heard the term malpractice. Malpractice is simply negligence on behalf of or undertaken by a professional, somebody who's held to a higher standard because of their status, their license. So, if you go to somebody to do your taxes and they're a certified public accountant, they're held to a higher standard than if you went to one of the places that, does them in a half an hour and the person may have a 2-year degree in bookkeeping or accounting, and they're just trained to fill out the forms for taxes. Lawyers are held out to be and licensed to be the experts in the law. So if a lawyer misses the statute of limitations or gives completely incorrect advice because they didn't check the law, they've committed malpractice and they're subject to damages. But again, if you follow the rules, if your lawyers, your employers follow the rules, you shouldn't have those circumstances come up. Now, Illinois regulates the practice of law by the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission of the Supreme Court of Illinois. I've given you a link to the IARD site. You can go on that site and you can find any lawyer in the state of Illinois. You can find if they've had any complaints or actions filed against them, or what their status is, if they are duly licensed at this present time, if they're keeping up their CLE or whatever the case may be. I also provided a link to the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct. Those are provided through the Illinois courts, through the Illinois Supreme Court, and they're in fact referred to as Supreme Court rules. So you'll see that and follow that link. That'll take you to those rules, and you need to go to those rules. In addition, there's indirect regulation of paralegals. And in the textbook and on the slides, I note, two primary organizations. I'll use the terms NIFPA and NALA, National Federation of Paralegal Associations, and the National Association of Legal Assistants. Now, those two organizations have traditionally competed, but they have model codes. And when I say compete, so around the Chicago area, most of the paralegal associations are related to or affiliated with NIFPA. The Central Illinois Paralegal Association, which is the one that you can join as a student, and Peggy Crane would have information on that. They give scholarships and things for students and allow student membership. It's a great way to meet with paralegals or get to know paralegals and potentially internships and employment. They're a NALA organization, but both have their own code of ethics that they suggest, because there's no real way to comply or make people comply, because you don't have a license that can be taken away like lawyers do. They suggest you follow those. And then indirectly, there's an increasing scope of paralegal responsibilities, but the ABA provides guidelines. And again, we're an ABA approved, and we follow ABA guidelines. We're an ABA approved paralegal program. Remember, on UPL, about half the states have a formal definition. Enforcement also varies widely. You have to know the details of your state regarding UPL. Illinois prosecutes it as a crime. The book talks about whether paralegals should be licensed. That's a debatable thing. My personal opinion, and I've held this opinion for most of the time that I've been a paralegal educator, is that you should. Now, that's going to mean that you have to meet certain requirements, but for the states that have kind of looked at that threshold, being a graduate of an ABA-approved program has been one of the requirements. It's a requirement to sit for most bar exams that you're a graduate of an ABA-approved law school. So I thought that's not a bad thing, right? For you. Now, you will have to probably do some of the same things I do, like meet a criteria, apply, take an exam or an ethical exam and a substantive law exam, maybe. You'll probably have to pay a licensing fee every year like I do, and probably have to commit or do continuing legal education, but you ought to do that anyway. I think that's where we will eventually get. Actually, I'm surprised that we haven't reached that point yet, but it always comes up, and you can see it taking hold, and it will get here. So you can expect that. So you're in a good place, because you will be graduates of an ABA approved program. Now, regarding the Illinois Code of Professional Responsibility, I won't read the full preamble that's listed on the slides. But I want to point out that it notes that the practice of law is a public trust. The lawyers are the trustees of the system. That means that we have to act for the benefit of the citizens of the state of Illinois regarding the law, implementation of the law, and the court system. Now, that comes into play for a lot of my beliefs. It comes into play in a lot of things you see played out in society. It also comes into play for a lot of reasons lawyers get bad names, because we question things. We seek to have justice on things. We tick people off because we seek to have justice on things. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But that preamble also says that we're supposed to do those things with integrity, maintaining the public confidence. We have to be competent, and we have to avoid anything or anybody, including policing ourselves, to turn anybody in who's trying to corrupt, abuse, or defraud the system. And I end that slide with, hold these representations as true or find another profession. And I mean that for you. That's a comment that I give to you, if you come back to me at one point and want to go to law school and want me to be, a reference for both law school, and you'll come back for your ethics part of the bar, and you want me to be a character witness, and then eventually after you pass the bar, you want me to be a reference for jobs. I'll remind you of that. It's something that you have to do. So I will remind you of that. There's two things listed in the slides, paralegal mays and may nots, and I would suggest that you try to memorize those for what they're worth. Essentially, those are two different ways of looking at what you can or can't do as a paralegal. In a positive or negative light, however it works best for you. But when you think about it, it outlines what you can do or what you can't do, what you should avoid. And if you memorize those mays or may nots, you won't fall on the other side, on the UPL side of getting in trouble. Okay? You'll do what you're supposed to do. Now, regarding the specific rules, I don't hit all of the rules in the slides, but I hit the ones that are most relevant to you. So competence. There's an ongoing duty to provide competent representation to every client. That means that you must have legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation necessary for whatever that representation is. You can pick up knowledge and skill. You can pick up knowledge by reading a book. You pick up skill by doing something. Not once, not twice, but over and over. You can pick up knowledge and skill by having a good mentor. Now, you may know what certain aspects of family law are once you take the family law course, but are you going to be competent to go out and, you know, help somebody through a divorce as a paralegal? No. So you work with somebody who is, and you gain knowledge and skill over time. Thoroughness and preparation, well, those are things that I obviously urge you to practice here in your classes. Be thorough, be prepared. You know, read the textbook when you're supposed to read the textbook. Make notes. Don't just listen to this podcast. Be taking notes. When I tell you you should memorize the mays and may nots, put in the time and effort to do that. That's thoroughness and preparation. Knowledge and skill you build over time with effort in your career. Thoroughness and preparation are a choice that you make, and it determines whether or not you're going to be competent. If you're not thorough and prepared, you're not going to be competent. If you're not thorough and prepared, you're not going to develop the legal knowledge and skill that you need to be competent. If you don't know what you're doing, there's an absolute obligation by this rule to secure the assistance of someone who can help you figure out what you're doing. Somebody who is competent already in that area of the law. And then the final thing, you need to remember that you can't go and engage somebody from outside your law firm to help you unless the client said it's okay. So if you go to get help, it needs to be somebody within the firm, or the client has to know that you're getting help outside the firm because they didn't hire somebody from outside the firm. Rule 1.2 talks about scope of representation, and the general rule is that you always abide by the client's decisions and wishes. I can limit the scope of my representation, but I have to get the client's consent to do so. And anytime I do anything like that, I make sure that they sign off on it. So they know that I'm only representing them to pursue child custody of their children, not to go and get the help them collect on the arrearage from child support from their first spouse, who owes them child support and thousands of dollars for other kids. And then it's improper to present or participate in presenting or threaten to present criminal charges to obtain an advantage in a civil matter. In other words, if you know somebody's fraudulent on their taxes or committed a criminal act, you can't say, hey, if you pay the judgment in this case or if you settle this case for X amount of dollars, I won't tell on your, you know, your other bad acts. Nope, you can't do that. Rule 1.3 tells us that we need to be diligent in everything we do. Diligence is doing things by the deadlines that the court imposes, the law expects, that you say you'll deliver things in. So use a calendar, right? Meet deadlines. That's, again, something that we're trying to push you to adopt now if you haven't already been doing those things prior to this program. Rule 1.4 talks about communication, and it requires that we keep the client reasonably informed and promptly reply to a client's request for information. Now, you have an absolute duty to provide explanations that are sufficient to a client, and it allows them to make decisions in their case. In this day and age where things are available, and in fact we have to file everything in court electronically, always provide the client with a copy of every single piece of correspondence that you either generate or you receive. Any documents that you receive or you generate, send copies. It's an easy, make sure it's the right document. It's an easy transmittal email, and make that a formal email. Don't, hey man, how you doing, or any emojis. A business letter type looking email. Please find and close this document that we received on your behalf, or this document we sent out on your behalf. And you can give a brief explanation. You've kept the client informed. And in other classes, I'll explain why that's important and how that'll make your life easier. Rule 1.5 deals with fees, and it just says that fees need to be reasonable. What is reasonable? Well, that depends on a lot of different factors, and we won't get into it here, but there are factors such as how difficult is the case? How experienced is the lawyer? You know, if you come to me for a case and, you know, my rate's higher than somebody else who's only been a lawyer for 5 or 6 years, well, I've got 25 years on them. I've got 25 years of additional experience. You know, my time is worth a little bit more because I have different level of competence maybe in that thing. Or if I'm specialized in a certain thing, I can command a higher fee. So fees are based on a lot of different things, including geography. You know, I have friends I went to law school with who stayed in the city of Chicago to practice law. Well, we have the same number of years and could have the same experience, but I might ask for fees that are lower simply because my overhead is lower. My rent for my office isn't as high. It doesn't cost me as much for parking. It doesn't cost me as much for utilities. It doesn't cost me as much for employees as it might in the city of Chicago where everything's higher. Rule 1.6 is very important. Confidentiality. Confidentiality essentially says, without a client's prior consent, you can't reveal anything about that client. This means not during or even after that representation has ended. Even after the client has passed away. Now, the definition of confidence is very broad, but I just say don't give up or let slip anything about your client to anybody outside of the office, and specifically anybody even within the office who's not working on that case. This is an important rule. You can't go home and talk to your spouse or significant other about it. Now, we've been doing Zoom classes. I've got a Zoom class and people are sitting in the living room listening to my class without headphones on. They got their, you know, spouse, partner, significant other, kids, dogs, everybody running through the living room. Everybody's hearing what we're doing. That's not providing confidentiality. So providing confidentiality is also making sure that you have those conversations in a place where confidence or privacy would be expected. So somebody comes up to you in the line at the Hy-Vee and starts to tell you about the case. No expectation of privacy, confidentiality for anything they say would be difficult to hold. So you say, hey, whoa, not here. You know, not in the parking lot, maybe in a car parked away from other people. But best place would be in the office or by a phone when both are, and not by speakerphone. You follow me? And I would avoid having these conversations by text, especially your personal phone. Rules 1.789 deal with conflicts of interest. Now, I'm not going to really break these down, but they're listed in there. You know what a conflict is because it smells like a conflict, it walks like a conflict, tastes like a conflict, it leaves this funky feeling. You know there's something not right about it. And if you come across that situation, you need to talk with the lawyer. And the lawyer ultimately needs to make the call, but the one that most often comes up is I can't represent a person that I'm suing now. I can't both be suing them and represent them. That's a clear conflict. I also can't represent somebody who is adverse to another client in some other pending case. You can't serve two different interests. All right, and that's the main one. But read the others and know those, and in other classes we will get into those much deeper. Rule 1.15 goes to safekeeping property, and your client's property has to be kept separate from your own, separate accounts, separate safes. Now, typically, we don't hold property, or I would not recommend that a lawyer holds any property of a client. Property could be, physical things, valuables. But it's also the one thing that you will hold is their file. The client owns the file that you create. And that gets lost by lawyers. You have a duty to keep that file safe, to keep the things that people give you to put in that file or things you acquire on behalf of the client's representation safely in that file. You have a duty to do that. So keep it safe, keep it secure, keep it organized. Don't let anything happen to it. I always use the example of, Michelle Weghorst can tell you the dean of our department was my paralegal in practice, and she'll tell you that I was very anal about my files. I used to get upset. Somebody had one of my files and things weren't put back in the proper place in that file. That file wasn't put back in the proper place. I would get upset because I had too much writing on it. My files were huge and they usually resulted in going to court in some way. And I wasn't there to get embarrassed or to lose on behalf of my client. I had a partner who was he did a different type of work and his files weren't as large. He had a lot more files, but they were smaller files. And he didn't keep his office or his files like I did. And that was just his way of practicing. But again, different business, different file, different type of file. So it wasn't probably as necessary for him to be so super, anal, I guess, about his files and make sure that everything's in a certain way, because his files were maybe inches, and mine were feet of paper. One day he's dictating, things, and he was coaching one of his kids in basketball or whatever. He had to get to a game. He had files all over his desk. He dictated three or four different things. Dictating is we used to talk into a recorder, and then somebody would type up what we had dictated. He puts the files just temporarily on the garbage can next to him as he's going through and dictating a letter. And he put it there, and he intended to take them and put them back in the file room or back on his desk, but he didn't. The cleaning lady comes in that night. What'd she do? A bunch of full garbage can and a bunch of stuff on top of the garbage can. I used to go and one of my mom's second jobs for a while was cleaning banks and office buildings after her first job. And so she'd come home and, we'd all get our dinner, and I had three siblings, and we'd all go with her afterwards and we'd help clean. We all had jobs. There's a garbage can that's full and had a bunch of files on it. You would think it was supposed to go in the garbage can. I would have tossed it in the garbage can. That's what happened, and we had to recreate those files. It was a very trying time. Declining or terminating representation, regardless of the scenario, the lawyer makes a call and it needs to be well documented. Now, just for your reference, and you'll get this more in different classes, declining representation, that refers to before the person is a client. So it's when the person wants to become my client and I say, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. There's a certain process that has to happen. Terminating representation is after I've already taken them on as a client. And if it's a situation where I've already filed a complaint or entered my appearance in a court case, I can't just walk away from that representation. Now I have to get the judge's okay and approval to withdraw. So two different things, and just if you recognize the word, the two words, declining would infer that you're not representing them yet, and terminating would infer that you are representing them, but trying to get out of that representation. I skipped to 3.1, meritorious claims and contentions. You can't do anything in court, you can't seek anything in court unless there's already authority for that thing. There's already a recognized type of cause of action, or there's a good faith argument for an extension of existing authority. Now, a good faith argument for extension is not, I feel this should be the law. It's typically some public policy thing, you know, statutes that have evolved in other states or case law that have come out of other states that have recognized this thing that would allow you to extend. And if you think about probably just over your lifetimes, you know, two major ones, same-sex marriage and weed, right? Great examples of when Illinois and other states sort of expanded the law. That came by people challenging the law or laws that prohibited those things, and the good faith argument for extending, you know, new authority, new positions in the law specifically. We had our rule on diligence in Rule 3.2. If it's litigation, and litigation is again when we're in court, it says you have to expedite, you have to be diligent. Don't need to say a lot more there. Rule 3.4 talks about fairness. Don't hide the ball. Don't play bad, or don't be bad. Don't lie, cheat, steal. Be fair. If you're supposed to provide something or do something, do it. Rule 3.5, the thing you need to remember is as a paralegal, you may go to court with your lawyer, especially when that lawyer is on trial, to help coordinate things at trial. Never communicate with the juror before or during a proceeding. Never. If a juror comes up to you because you're living in a, you know, smaller community like Peoria, and you go out to lunch or you're coming back to court, and that juror is coming in the same door you're coming into the courthouse, and they recognize you, you meet eyes, it's likely they're going to say hello to you. That's fine. Say hello back. But then tell your lawyer, and your lawyer has an obligation to tell the judge, and the judge will decide whether it's something that they need to inquire with the juror about to just make sure that the juror hasn't already predetermined a favor for or against your side of the case. It's what the rule seeks. Dealing with others. Rule 4.2 talks about dealing with a person represented by counsel, by a lawyer. And the thing you need to know about this is if somebody's represented by a lawyer, you don't communicate with them. You can't do that without express, which means written authorization of that person's lawyer, and that person's lawyer is almost never going to give you permission to talk to that individual without their presence. Rule 4.3. So in other words, Rule 4.2 goes to parties, typically. Somebody on the opposite side of your case or your client's case. The defendant, okay, or the plaintiff if you represent the defendant. 4.3 deals with those same parties, but one of the parties isn't represented or isn't represented yet. They're unrepresented. You can't pretend you're their friend. You have to make sure they know who you represent and what your motives are, because usually you have motives. You're trying to move them along in the case, and you have the advantage because you represent somebody who's hired a lawyer, your boss. Rule 4.4 deals with an maybe more important group, third people, third person, third persons, witnesses. These are witnesses typically. These are people, and some of you may have been called to be a witness in a case. These are people who have nothing to gain except to be inconvenienced because they saw something or have something to offer regarding an issue that's now in court. And you need to recognize that this is an inconvenience, and there's more potential benefits than not by trying to avoid inconveniencing those people. Put yourself in their shoes. Now, you'll see, and I hope I never hear that it's coming from you or a lawyer you work for, but it happens all the time where the lawyer's office will determine that the lawyer's time is more important than these witnesses. And so when the person says, well, my job is 8 to 3 every day, and if I'm not at work, I don't get paid. So can we schedule my statement or my deposition after 3 o'clock? Well, if you're my paralegal, the answer is, yeah, including weekends. You're going to do whatever you can to make sure that person gets to go to work and we're not taking food off their table. But you will have opponents who say, no, Mr. So-and-so is that busy, can't be there, blah, blah, blah. We have to do this at 10 o'clock. And you say, well, but the witness, Mr. Smith, has to be at work. If he's not at work, he doesn't get paid. If he doesn't get paid, his kids don't eat. And they may still not care. Well, if it's me on the other side, if I'm your boss, then I'm going to say, nope, not doing it. Doing it at 3 o'clock or 3:30, whenever it's convenient for that person. And then we'll take it to the judge if we have to. The point is, if you don't treat these people like you'd like to be treated under their circumstances, it will come back to bite you. The most upstanding and typically honest individual will get ticked off and change the facts in their case. They will change the facts of their testimony. They will figure out a way to do you for doing them. So respect third persons. They don't have any other reason to be there. They're not a party in the case. And some of you who may have been witnesses, you know this firsthand. The last rule that I want to talk about is 5.3. Rule 5.3 essentially says that the lawyer must train, support, and take responsibility for you and all the other people who work in the office. Subordinate lawyers, paralegals, all support staff. This means, in addition to, you know, supporting you and taking responsibility for you, that they're responsible for making sure you get continuing legal education. And so you should push for that always. You should ask for it, and you should hopefully get the same amount of CLE that they get. And we're required to do 30 hours every 2 years. So if it's good enough for me to know the updates on the law, it's good enough for you to need to know it too. Malpractice, again, is negligence by a professional. But if a lawyer follows and a paralegal follows the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct, you're going to be less likely to slip up, miss something, you know, or find yourself in that malpractice realm. So in summary, attorneys are regulated by licensing requirements and ethical rules of the state. Model codes and model rules spell out ethical and professional duties. You should state or should consult your state's ethical code, our ethical code, the one we just went through and the one you should be looking up. You're regulated indirectly through your supervising lawyer. Illinois does prohibit UPL, and you should know what UPL stands for and that it in fact comes with penalties that may apply to you if you breach that law. Always know if you move to other states whether paralegals are regulated or how they're expected to be regulated, and look up those ethical codes. Again, come back and re-listen to this before next week's assignment. You know, Chapter 4, we're taking 2 weeks and a good hard look at the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct. Next week, we'll focus more on the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct, but come back and listen to this podcast. It covers both weeks, and you should listen to it twice. This is something you need to be serious about and have drilled into your heads as something that you definitely want to take serious. So this has taken us past the quarter of the semester part, this podcast. We're going through weeks 4 and 5. I appreciate your efforts the first 3 weeks. I look forward to seeing what you come up with this week.